This is On Being's Unheard Cut. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Walter Brueggemann. He is professor emeritus at Columbia Theological Seminary in Georgia. I spoke with him on May 18th, 2011, at the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. This interview is included in our show, The Prophetic Imagination of Walter Brueggemann. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
Car was that was supposed to pick me up mm-hmm. went off with some other passenger, so then they had to mobilize another car.
That's
or
so
something.
Funny.
So, yeah.
Sorry about that.
But I guess if you travel enough, it's going to happen. So,
you know, I didn't meet you, but I saw you years ago at. Do you remember? Do you know that preaching conference that they? Who is it? The Episcopal EES. Preaching Excellence Conference.
Yes,
do they still do that in the summertime?
Yep, right.
So when I was at YDS, I got invited to do that, and it would have been like the I was pregnant with my daughter, so it was like 92 or something, 93.
Yep.
And you were there.
Mm-hmm.
It was in St. Louis.
Yep.
Is that where Eden is?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yep, right.
And also that amazing woman, Peggy. What was her name?
Peggy Way?
I think
in
so.
In pastoral care? It's the only Peggy I know in the field.
I don't know if Peggy's the right name.
I don't know.
Do you remember who else spoke with you? Someone else from Eden.
No, I don't.
Was she in a wheelchair?
Yeah. That would have been she.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I soaked you up then. I read you, of course, too. But one thing, even my colleagues who haven't gone to seminary, when your name came up, when we realized you'd be in town, Trent, I think, especially said, your name comes up. People quote you as often as anyone else gets quoted.
Mm.
Your name gets dropped a lot. I don't know if you appreciate that. So we thought, well, we can get the real thing here.
Yeah, right.
and you got your Bible.
Yeah.
Well, should we just go? Or Chris? Yes. Okay. All right. Let's just do it. Do you have any questions of me before we start?
No, I'll follow you.
All right. I take off this loud bracelet. So where I start with everyone is I'd just like to hear a little bit about the religious background of your childhood.
Yep. I'm the son of a pastor. My father was a German evangelical pastor in rural Missouri, and I grew up in very much a church culture. I think that shaped me not only as a believer, but it shaped me toward ministry,
mm-hmm.
and that's the flow of my life then, and that was an antecedent of the United Church of Christ, so that's my home denomination and
mm-hmm.
has been all my life. Yep.
I read somewhere that you remembered the conflict when your father urged his congregation to abandon German.
Oh, yes.
So it was a German-speaking congregation?
Yeah, well, that crisis really came in the Second World War when you didn't want to speak German anymore. But my
so it
father,
wasn't a theological decision?
It was. But it's like every immigrant community. The older people really thought that true theological talk could only happen in your mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
My father then preached once a month in German into the 1950s because the old people needed to hear those sounds.
Hmm.
And his insistence was, if you don't move away from that, you will, like every immigrant community, lose the next generation. He had some tough nuts to crack about that.
Mm-hmm. Did you speak German at home?
No. See, the years when I should have learned it at home were the years when you didn't want to talk German.
Uh-huh.
But both my parents from childhood were bilingual,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I should have learned it as an Old Testament teacher.
Right.
So I've been trying to learn it all my adult life instead of that.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it's funny, with German, I spent most of my 20s, most of the 80s in Germany, in Berlin. Was not religious. I was a completely political person. I was a journalist. I was with the State Department.
Really?
Then, when a couple years later I ended up going to seminary, which is not something I would ever have imagined in those political years,
yeah.
reading and speaking German was a huge advantage, right?
Of course
it was. I could
go
to the library and get all these great texts and read them in the language.
Well, and until maybe even 20, 25 years ago, the important stuff was still in German. That's changed now, but
I don't, this may be a stretch, but when I read that story, it made me wonder if that struggle over language, if it had anything to do with your later concern about, you know, the particularities of language, of the biblical text, the preaching voice, the church and the world.
Yeah.
Did all of that form you?
I think I never thought of it that way, but I'm sure it does. How one moves from language to language. And I really think that Richard and Reinhold Niebuhr, in whose tradition I stand, one of the things that made them great is that they could move back and forth between those languages and between those cultures. Mm-hmm. And so I think that particularity has been very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Do you remember when the biblical prophets first entered your imagination? Was that something about the biblical text that was interesting to you?
I think my father probably attended to that some because he was on the right side of all the justice questions. But I don't think I really computed that till I was in seminary.
Mm-hmm.
But I had great Old Testament teachers in seminary, and that really was made clear and inescapable then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, so your book, The Prophetic Imagination, continues to be such an important book. And I
think it's probably my fallback position. And sometimes I look at it now and I think either, gee, I already saw that then, or I think, wow, I haven't moved at all.
Well, right. I mean, there is a sense in which everything you've done since then builds on
that right.
And
it
flows from it.
Yeah.
But so I guess I'm still kind of curious. So, you know, how did you get captured by that, the prophetic imagination in particular in this text?
Well, my teacher in my doctoral work was James Meilenberg, and Jeremiah was his thing.
Mm.
And he's the one that really taught me to pay attention to the nuance of the language. And, and if you just keep looking at these same texts every day of your life, year after year, you either give up on it or you get taken in by it.
Mm-hmm.
And, the force of their language is just kind of inexhaustible. And so I would always tell my students as we were studying the prophets, this stuff sounds like it was written yesterday, because the contemporaneity of it is so immediate. And
was something that captured you about the prophets.
Did
right
indeed,
away.
Yeah.
So, most people don't have theological education. Most Christians don't have theological education.
Right.
Most Christians don't even necessarily have really basic tools for reading those texts in a powerful and nuanced way. So if I ask you kind of the introductory question, I ask you to be a teacher. You know, if you had to say, who were the prophets? You know, what were they about, and what's particular about that piece of the Bible?
Well, I think they were the two things that are important, it seems to me, is on the one hand, they were rooted in the covenantal traditions of whatever was from Moses and Sinai and all of that. And the other thing is that they are completely uncredentialed and without pedigree.
Okay.
So they just rise up in the landscape. And the way I put it now is that they imagine their contemporary world differently according to that old tradition. So it's tradition and imagination. There's no way to explain that, so we explain it by the work of the Spirit, but I don't think you have to say that. I just think they are moved the way every good poet is moved to have to describe the world differently according to the gifts of their insight.
Hmm.
And And of course, in their own time and every time since, the people that control the power structure do not know what to make of them, so they characteristically try to silence them. And what power people always discover is that you cannot finally silence poets. They just keep coming at you and, in threatening and transformative ways.
So you have your Bible with you, and I mean, if I asked you just to read what for you is a, I want to also step back and say there are a number of prophets, right? And they have very different characteristics, voices, themes. They were speaking to different times in the history of the Israelites. So there's not one prophet or one prophetic voice. But if I just asked you to choose kind of a quintessential passage, maybe Jeremiah, maybe Isaiah, or maybe just one that has remained especially meaningful to you over the years, and just kind of
I'll read since the prophets characteristically revolve around judgment and hope. I'll do two passages and one of each of them. The judgment passage that I'll read is in Jeremiah 4. It goes like this. I looked, and you don't know who I is. I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and lo, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and lo, there was no one at all, and all the birds of the air had fled. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all its cities were laid waste before the anger, before his fierce anger. Well, you get the I looked, I looked, I looked. And what that text really is creation in reversal. So you go from heaven and earth to mountains to birds to humans, and he's describing it all being taken away at one time. And when I hear that kind of poetry, I get chill bumps about because it seems to me so contemporary that I think that's how very many people are now experiencing the world. It is as though the ordered world is being taken away from us, and it's just so powerful and exquisite. Yeah. The other text I'll read is one made famous by Gerhard von Rad, the great 20th century one.
One of those German theologians.
That's right. But this is Isaiah 43. It's a very much used passage. Do not remember the former things, nor the consider the things of old. I am about to do a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? And apparently what he's telling his people is just forget about the Exodus, forget about all the ancient miracles, and pay attention to the new miracles of rebirth and new creation that God is enacting before your very eyes. And I often wonder when I read that, what was it like the day the poet got those words, and what did it feel like, and how did he share that? And, of course, we don't know any of that. So it just keeps ringing in our ears.
You and I were together this morning at a gathering of preachers, and I think that both of those themes that you named of, you know, what feels like chaos, but then the hope that, and I think even an insistence that this must somehow give rise to new forms. The fact that we don't know how the world is going to be structured differently, or you know, what will survive that we recognize, makes it still stressful, even if it's hopeful. But
that's right. But the amazing contemporaneity of this material is that the issues are the same. That the world we have trusted in is vanishing before our eyes, and the world that is coming at us feels like a threat to us, and we can't quite see the shape of it. And I think that is kind of where the church and the preachers of the church have to live, people don't much want to hear either one of those words, that the world is vanishing or that a new world is coming to us, mm-hmm. which is why this kind of poetry always leaves us uneasy, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that you also think that that unease is a holy thing, or can be a holy thing, that in fact the Bible calls the faithful not to be too settled and
well,
too comfortable.
I think that's exactly right.
That's countercultural, though.
It is countercultural because our consumer culture wants somehow to narcotize us so that we just settle in on things. And I think I think Kafka maybe said that a poet or a novelist is like a pickaxe that attacks the way we've got things arranged. And I think these poems are like pickaxes that are not welcome among us, but we're gonna miss out on the reality of our life if we are narcotized both about the loss and about the newness.
You know, here's some words from The Prophetic Imagination, your book in 1978. They're very poetic, too. Our consumer culture, following on what you just said, our consumer culture is organized against history. There is a deprecation of memory and a ridicule of hope, which means everything must be held in the now, either an urgent now or an eternal now.
Well, I'm glad I said that.
Yeah. You know, you're naming something when you call the prophets poets.
Yeah.
You're naming qualities of this text, this Bible, that people think they know so well, but in fact, and partly because of the way these things were translated and transmitted, I don't think I grew up realizing how much of the Bible is poetry.
That's right.
And the other thing that you, the reason that also matters, and that's true of the Hebrew Bible in particular, and also this realization, which is very simple but not brought home very often, is that this was the text of Jesus. This was his scripture.
Right. That's right. And he obviously knew it so well. But even in the more liberal theological tradition in which I was raised, we only talked about the prophets as moral teachers, mm-hmm. and there was no attention to the artistic, aesthetic quality of how they did that, but it is the only way in which you can think outside of the box. Otherwise, even liberal passion for justice just becomes another ideology, and it does not have transformative power. That's what's extraordinary about the poetry, that it's so elusive that it refuses to be reduced to a formula.
Okay.
And I think that's a great temptation among liberals who care about justice, is to reduce it to a formula. And
to then create another ism.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the poetry comes and breaks that open again.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, right.
That's that power of language and forms of language.
That's right.
Yep. You know, so one thing I thought might be interesting is to walk through some of the words that that are there in your writing that come from these prophetic texts,
right.
That are not words that are really part of a modern vocabulary. You know, one of them is lamentations.
Yeah.
You know what? Tell me about
lamentations. Lamentation is a big piece of my research and my passion. The Book of Lamentations is a collection of poems that grieve the loss of Jerusalem that's been destroyed. But the Book of Psalms, at least one-third of the Book of Psalms, are songs or prayers of sadness and loss and grief and upset, very much the Old Testament experience of faith is having stuff taken away from us. And what's so interesting is that in the institutional church, with the lectionary and the liturgies, the whole business of Lamentations has been screened out. Because
we don't know what to do with those depressing passages.
Yeah, and we don't want to because of consumer capitalism. You just go from triumph to triumph to well-being to ease to prosperity, and you never have any brokenness. My way of teaching that is to say that the destruction of Jerusalem is the Old Testament equivalent to 9/11. That's their 9/11.
You know, I just remembered that in the days after 9/11, I interviewed a bunch of people, including, and I can't even remember who this was, but some pastor, theologian, biblical scholar who read that first line of Lamentations, "How lonely sits the city."
Yeah. Yeah, it just fits so well. Mm-hmm. And because we have neglected the lament pieces, we are ill-equipped for the loss that we are facing in our society. Mm. So we keep pretending and denying that that's not happening to us.
Mm. I felt like one of the spiritual experiences of 9/11, not that we maybe knew how to name this, that's what you're talking about,
right,
was Americans experienced vulnerability in their strongest fortresses, which is an experience that a lot of people in the world have a lot of the time, but it was completely new to us.
That's right.
In this generation.
That's right. And I think particularly for young people who didn't even have the Second World War behind them, as my generation
does.
Right, right. We just thought it could not happen here. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what they thought in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. They thought, we are God's guaranteed people, and it can't happen here. Mm-hmm. And that's what produced this incredible poetry, I think.
Mm.
And, right.
So another term is that arises in your writing that echoes the biblical text is steadfast love.
Mm-hmm.
Not just love, but steadfast
That's right.
love. So
That's
tell
right.
me about the combination of those two words.
Well, the two words together are a translation of the Hebrew word chesed. And I think in the King James Bible, they are translated loving kindness.
Okay.
And our ways of translating that tend to be kind of sweet and romantic. But I think it really means covenantal reliability.
Okay.
It's okay to say love as long as you don't sweeten it or make it romantic. But I think the best image of it is the capacity of a dog to get prey by the throat and just hold on to it. That's the kind of love that God is said to practice, and is the kind of love that Israel in covenant is expected to practice toward the neighbor.
Hmm.
And so the lament psalms in the book of Psalms, to some extent, are an argument with God that God has not kept steadfast love as God promised to do. So then you get that argument. But essentially, that's what all of our intimate arguments are about, is always the other party who has not kept steadfast love with us according to our mutual commitments and so on.
Mm.
So, yeah.
It's like the love of a long marriage rather than something that's, you fall into and fall out
that's
of.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Right.
A word you've used a lot recently, maybe you always used it, I think it echoes in what you wrote, but is disruptive.
Yeah, no, that's more recent in
okay.
my,
well, tell
my,
me
very,
about that
my very limited vocabulary.
Yeah. Tell me about that word. Again, I don't think that's a word we associate in American culture with religion or the Bible or churches.
Yeah. Well, I think we think in terms of systems and continuities and predictability and schemes and plans. And I think the Bible is to some great extent focused on God's capacity to break those schemes open and to violate those formulae. When they are positive disruptions, the Bible calls them miracles. We tend not to use that word when they are negative.
Right.
But what it means is that the reality of our life and the reality of God are not contained in most of our explanatory schemes. And whether one wants to explain that in terms of God or not, it is nonetheless the truth of our life, that our lives are arenas for all kinds of disruptions because it doesn't work out the way we planned. Mm-hmm. And I think our recent economic collapse is a huge disruption for many people who had their retirement mapped out or whatever like that, and it isn't going to be like that. And what the Bible pretty consistently does is to refer all of those disruptions to the hidden power of God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And does that satisfy modern people to think of it that way? What kind of God is that?
Well, I think that's... if you use the word modern to refer to the 18th, 19th century rationality that we can think it all through, then of course it doesn't fit with that. But that's very much like the situation in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had all worked out, and Jesus became a great disruptive force who finally had to be executed because the empire can never tolerate that kind of disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that you could say in our contemporary experience of the end of apartheid in South Africa, or even these incredible street movements in Mideast countries now, those are incredible disruptions that establishment power doesn't know what to deal with, and what establishment power always learns too late is that there are not enough guns and there are not enough dogs and there's not enough armaments finally to stop that disruptive force. So we're watching that played out again in some of those countries. So the connection that the Bible makes between lived disruption and the reference to God really fuels a great deal of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I heard you speak very poignantly this morning to preachers about the fact that there are things that can't be said from the pulpit, sometimes that it feels like they should be said. You said there are silences that it's hard to break.
Yeah.
That following on the way we're talking about this, it's hard for preachers, religious leaders to adopt this prophetic voice or draw on these prophetic themes.
Yep.
And, I think even if you and I talk about this, it's kind of a difficult conversation to have in this culture.
It's a very difficult.
Right?
And I think the difficulty is that all of us, liberals and conservatives, all of us are basically contained in the ideology of consumer capitalism. And we want that to be our universe of meaning. And when you get a poetic articulation that moves outside of that, it's just too anxiety-producing for most of us. So we try to stop that kind of talk. And in a local church, obviously, people have a lot of leverage for being able to stop that kind of talk.
So what is it hard for preachers to talk about here? What?
Well, I think at the broadest level, it is hard to talk about the fact, I think it's a fact, that our society has chosen a path of death in which we have reduced everything to a commodity. We believe that there are technical solutions to everything. We believe that we are entitled to a disproportionate amount of the world's goods and resources and so on. That's all phoniness, but we don't want that exposed as a phoniness. So it doesn't matter whether you talk about the over-reliance on technology, the mad pursuit of commodity goods, our passion for violence now, expressed as our war policies. All of those are interrelated to each other, and none of us, very few of us, none of us really want to have that exposed as an inadequate and dehumanizing way to live. And I think if one is grounded in the truth of the gospel as a Christian, that's what we have to talk about. So preachers are really put in a very difficult fix of having been entrusted to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, but they also, and they also belong to this
That's
culture.
Right.
These characteristics are part of our birthright.
That's right. They are.
This is the world we're born into.
That's right. And preachers are as deeply implicated in it as anyone else. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
You also you named the Iraq War.
Yep. Yep.
That was a hard thing to talk about in the pulpit.
Yep.
Without being really controversial and inflammatory, that one was speaking about this in a critical way.
Right.
But that you think that is the kind of thing that the preachers must be naming.
I think that's
wrestling
right.
Wrestling with in whatever.
I think that's right. And when you do that, of course, it comes through to some people as simply liberal cant, mm-hmm. and not really the voice of the gospel. Because it's not only tied up with our military ideology, but it's all tied up for specific families who have sons and daughters in the service, and it sounds like a repudiation mm-hmm. of them. So it gets to be a very complex issue, but we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it so that that sort of stuff doesn't become commonplace and assumed as normal among us. It's quite abnormal to be committed to that way in the world.
You know, I think that this larger point that you've been making about the aesthetic, literary, poetic sensibility of the prophetic tradition, that the very language is different and transformative, that it takes that voice out of political boxes.
Yeah.
Because I'm really aware that a lot of words that religious people treasure and that are core, I mean, the word justice, the yep. word peace, these words themselves are tarnished in our culture.
That's right.
They have all kinds of political association and baggage, right? I mean,
that's right.
They're liberal or they're conservative
yep.
or they belong to some agenda.
That's right.
And I think that's also a problem when preachers start talking about those things.
That's right.
All of that accumulates around it.
That's right.
The message is not clear and the message may not be powerful and it may not be heard.
That's right. Which is why a poetic preacher always has to try to find another way to say it. I've recently been thinking more and more, it's so astonishing that the Old Testament prophets hardly ever discuss an issue. They don't discuss abortion or
issue.
The Panama Canal
or
anything like that. And I think what they're doing is they're going underneath the issues that preoccupy people to the more foundational assumptions that can only be gotten at in elusive language. Mm. And very much the institutional church has been preoccupied with issues.
Mm-hmm. Which automatically puts you on one side of an issue or on the other side
of
the issue.
And when we do that, we are robbed of transformative power. Because then it's ideology versus ideology mm-hmm. that does not produce very good outcomes for anyone.
Can you think of an example where you've seen a religious leader or a community kind of subvert that? I mean, get outside that issues based or?
Well, I think Martin Luther King did sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think at his best, he was a biblical poet.
Right.
If you just think of "I Have a Dream,"
right. Which is
it just kind of mm-hmm. soared away. He wasn't really talking about enacting a civil rights bill, except mm-hmm. that he was. And you know, but it was language that was out beyond the quarrels that we do. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens from time to time like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you make the connection. There's something else. I really enjoyed reading some of your sermons. You have a new book, a new collection of mm-hmm. sermons, right? So yep. I have the galleys of that.
Yeah.
It hasn't been
well,
published.
Do you?
Yeah, and I
don't,
loved
so.
That. Well, enough. I didn't correct it for you,
right.
Sorry. But this, I think, was from one of your sermons. You were talking about the need for a city to care about injustice or poverty and despair is not liberalism or socialism or welfare or radicalism. I mean, after all, liberals and conservatives share those same biblical texts,
right?
But you said it is simply genuine humanness authorized by the God of the Bible. But even drawing that, circling back to that connection.
Yeah, yeah.
Then kind of reframes, well, what's at stake
yeah.
here?
And I think very much it's so hard to do, but the task is reframing so that we can re-experience the social realities that are right in front of us mm-hmm. from a different angle. I think that's right.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so, you know, something else that comes up in my mind, you were introduced as someone who's strident, said proudly strident. And the prophets were strident, right? They were uncomfortable.
That's right.
I think also, I've thought about this a lot because we do, you know, I've done a lot of conversations across the years about some historic figures. I mean, people who changed the world usually yeah. were not, they often started in their 20s. And before everyone realized they'd changed the world, they drove everyone around them crazy, right?
That's right.
And that's what the prophets do in the Bible. That's the model.
Yep.
And then right now, at this moment in time in our culture, we have this world which feels like it's been poisoned by giving so much attention to strident voices, right? Mm-hmm. Only strident voices on every side of any issue. So how can you, do you struggle to champion the prophetic voice? How do you define that over against righteous indignation,
yeah.
right? Or stridency that is toxic.
Yeah.
Because it may not look so different, you know what
right.
I'm saying?
Right. I wouldn't choose to use the word strident for myself, but it is deliberate on my part when I get to talk to clergy that I do a lot of to do what I do as boldly as I can to try to model and energize preachers to be bold about what they do. But I think it is the courage that comes from the conviction that you've been entrusted with something important. And if you do it that way, rather than it being a self-announcement, mm-hmm. the accent is on the message and not the messenger. It doesn't need to be strident in an alienating kind of way.
So that's one way to make a distinction.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That what one would wish is that it is emancipatory for people who are hearing you rather than affrontive. But it is a very delicate line,
mm-hmm.
and I no doubt cross over that sometimes. Yeah.
Who do you think of? Do you think of people who you imagine as prophets among us today?
Well, a king, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Tutu. I read a mm-hmm. a biography of him, and I had no idea how long he had been courageous before he became Bishop Tutu.
Right, right. And I guess maybe it's in the nature of this that you don't recognize a prophet
I think that's
in their
right.
lifetime.
It's kind of in retrospect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think Coffin, Berrigan, those are the names that would come first to my
mm-hmm.
mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if the prophets of the Old Testament really were uncredentialed people without pedigrees, then we ought not to expect people to arise primarily in the institutional church.
Right, or even maybe be famous people.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of people who are not broadly famous, mm-hmm. who in their own local circumstance do transformative things.
Are those good life-giving disruptive forces?
That's exactly right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You said somewhere in another interview, I'm always a little bit careful about quoting other interviews because they don't always get written down correctly.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about this because it was very intriguing that some of these issues, sexual issues, that are so galvanizing and so polarizing in our time, in churches and outside them.
Yeah.
You said that you really don't think that's about particularities of guilt or sin, but about a sense of impending chaos.
Yes.
Which kind of goes back to that first prophetic text you
read. That's right, yeah.
So are you saying that people have a sense of impending chaos and for some reason, maybe because these things are so intimate, this is what they latch on to as...
That's exactly what I think. I've asked myself, why in the church does the question of gays and lesbians have such adrenaline? And I've decided for myself... that means most of what we're arguing about with gays and lesbians has nothing to do with gays and lesbians. It is rather that the world is not the way we thought it was going to be. There have always been gays and lesbians, but we'd have to acknowledge them. And it's not fashionable anymore to protest pushy blacks. It's not fashionable to protest pushy women. You know, those mm-hmm. those battles are lost or won.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still have great moral indignation around gays and lesbians. And so I think what has happened is that we've taken all of our anxiety about the old world disappearing and we've dumped it all on that issue.
Mm.
And so I have concluded that it's almost futile to have the theological argument about gays and lesbians anymore because that's not what the argument's about.
I see.
It is an amorphous anxiety that we are in free fall as a society. And I think we kind of are in free fall as a society. But I don't think it has anything to do with gays and lesbians, particularly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. What kind of church do you belong to?
A member and have ordination standing in the United Church of Christ. I now worship at an Episcopal church.
Mm-hmm.
That's largely because the liturgy of the Episcopal church has become very meaningful to me, and so I find that a good home to be in. But I have all kinds of deep attachments to the United Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess what I'm also getting at is, you know, what does a healthy church look like to you? Churches are institutions, right?
Yeah.
They're all, none of them are perfect. They're
That's right.
run by human
yeah.
beings. So they have a,
yeah.
But given that... you know, what draws you to a church now in this?
Well, I would think for myself, it's thoughtful preaching, missional energy, and a relative honesty about a spectrum of opinion that is taken seriously in the church. I don't want to belong to a church that is homogeneous. In which everybody thinks like I do, though I'd be glad if a majority thought like I did.
Right.
But it's a gathering of people who are using their best resources to try to follow Jesus, and I don't think there's one way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what churches do. Local congregations is a matter of indifference to me at my age and all of that. But those are kind of the indispensables of that. And I have been led to a church that that fulfills those practices in ways that are very significant to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, another one of those words that it recurs a lot in your writing that comes also from the text is... It's another word that we don't have in our culture very often is mercy. You know, mm-hmm. We talk about forgiveness. We talk about reconciliation.
Yep.
Mercy to me is something different, something bigger. And
yep.
Tell me about that.
You may know that the Hebrew word for Phyllis Tribble has taught us that the Hebrew word for mercy is the word for womb mm-hmm. with different vowel points. And so mercy, she suggested, is womb-like mother love. And it is the capacity of the mother to totally give oneself over to the need and reality and identity of the child. And mutatis mutandis, then, mercy is the capacity to give oneself away for the sake of the neighborhood. Now, none of us do that completely, mm-hmm. But it makes a difference if the quality of social transactions have to do with the willingness to give oneself away for the sake of the other rather than the need to always be drawing all of the resources to myself for my own well-being. So it is this kind of generous connectedness to others. And then I think our task is to see how that translates into policy. And now we're having huge political storms about whether our policies ought to reflect that kind of generosity to people other than us and people to who are not as well off as we are or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a community or a society finally cannot live without the quality of mercy. The problem for us is what will initiate that, what will break the pattern of self-preoccupation enough to notice that the others are out there and that we are attached to them.
Right. It's that attachment,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Oh, I also think about, I think in Arabic that word merciful is also connected to womb. It's the same.
Well, it wouldn't surprise
it would be the
me.
Same, if it, right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? It takes me back to a conversation I had with a scientist, who's clinical psychologist, who's studying forgiveness and revenge, and how forgiveness is made more possible. And I mean, studying what happens in the brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that biologically, we become able to care in larger and larger, wider and wider circles when we see others' well-being as linked to our own.
Yes.
And of course, the mother, the womb, and the maternal love is an ultimate expression of that.
That's right, because the whole womb process is a terrible inconvenience. but it's an inconvenience.
I know that better than you do.
I bet you do. But yeah. But it's an inconvenience that finally is defining for our life, mm-hmm. as the mother mm-hmm. lives into.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. We sang a hymn this morning. Something about God is the umbilical connection to us. I thought it was very interesting to get that language into a new hymn.
Mm.
So, it's great.
You want to change tapes? Okay. I'm having a good time. I hope you are.
Me too.
We'll let them change tapes. We'll just talk 10 or 15 more minutes.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, good.
But we can't talk about anything serious. Do you know Ellen Davis well?
Not real well, but I know her as a colleague.
She was my professor of Old Testament at Yale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Her new book. And has remained a good friend.
Her new book is just extraordinary.
I know, it's terrific.
Yeah, right. All the research she did from the science side of that and agriculture.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that's, you know, the way she described it to me. I was in her introduction to the Old Testament class, which was the first time she taught that.
Mm.
And she did tell me recently that it was in that process that she realized that she was tripping over the word land every other paragraph.
All the time.
Right.
Yep.
And that it was in that she then went deeper and deeper into that and got involved with all these interesting land stewardship and taken it so
many
I
had that
directions.
Experience when I started reading Wendell Berry, who worked with her.
Right.
It was the word place that keeps coming up in his novels all the time like that. So,
I'd love to talk about your image of God. And I want you to talk about that more personally, but I thought I might start with, you know, for example, in one of your sermons, you are talking about some poetry, Isaiah. And you talk about that it offers five images for God. This is just one, one passage in Isaiah. Yeah. A demolition squad, a safe place for poor people who have no other safe place, the giver of the biggest dinner party you ever heard of, a powerful sea monster, he will swallow up death forever, a gentle nursemaid who will wipe away every tear from all faces. How are normal people, not biblical scholars, how are they to make sense of a text like that, of a God, of who God is?
Well, they're going to make sense of it if they had good preachers and teachers to help them pause long enough to take in the imagery. Mm-hmm. But you see, what the church does with its creeds and its doctrinal tradition, it flattens out all the images and metaphors to make it fit into a nice little formulation, and then it's deathly. So we have to communicate to people, if you want a God that is healthier than that, you're going to have to take time to sit with these images and relish them and let them become a part of your prayer life and your vocabulary and your conceptual frame. Otherwise, you're just going to be left with these dead formulations. Which, again, is why the poetry is so important.
Right.
Because the poetry just keeps opening and opening and opening, whereas the doctrinal practice of the church is always to close and close and close until you are left with nothing that has any transformative power. And I think I probably learned this from Sally McFaig, that the biblical defense against idolatry is plural metaphors. And if you reduce the metaphors too much, you will end with an idol. So more metaphors gives more access to God, and one can work one metaphor a while, but you can't treat that as though that's the last word, and you got to move and have another and another. That's what I think. And it's just amazing in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, there are just endless metaphors. Yeah.
It is, it's such an important and kind of a disruptive point in a good way, right? Because dwelling with the images, again, is very different from memorizing Bible verses.
That's right.
Which is what I grew up being taught to do.
Yeah.
And it's even different from reading the Bible.
That's right. That's right. I happen to think memorizing Bible verses is a good thing, because then you have the text available that can yield this stuff. Mm-hmm. But unless you understand that the verses you've memorized want to keep exploding and disrupting, you don't really have much. I think that's exactly right, because what a metaphor or an image does is to invite you to keep walking around it and looking at it another way and noticing something else. It's a gift that keeps on giving.
Okay.
And most of our handling of the Bible is not understood that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if I asked you this way, in terms of your image of God, you know, are there metaphors that has spoken to you across time, or that speak to you now, that didn't before? Are there metaphors that have come to you in all in your life as a human being and in your study as a scholar and your work as a preacher to be more and more meaningful?
Well, I think they basically arise out of my continuing to look at the text, and it depends on what text I'm looking at. Obviously, mm-hmm. that is then related to what's going on in my life that day. But if you, for example, if I take the phrase, and I can't even remember where it is, but let me be the apple of your eye. That's a very strange phrase.
Right.
But what that pictures is a God who's a big eye that looks at you caringly and treasuring you. So what I imagine from that, it's like being a little kid that's lost in a department store, and you finally go around the corner, and there's your mother looking at you, and you're safe again.
Right.
So I want to have God look at me that way. Now, I don't want to construct a whole theology out of that phrase, but that's enough for that day,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be given another phrase another day like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how my mind works. It doesn't yield a doctrinal package. It just yields a bunch of fragments that are not easily fit together. But the reason that works for me is that I am aware that I, as a person with identity, I am essentially a collection of fragments that do not fit very well together. So that's okay.
Mm. The other thing about poetic language and imagery is that it has a capacity to change as you change and grow as you grow.
That's right.
Or, I mean, not that it does, but, you know, so that you can read it 1 year and read it 20 years later, and there will be something there that you didn't see before.
That's right.
It's kind of
what
you're saying, that speaks to you.
That's right.
Then.
That's right. And the challenge for a preacher is when a preacher gets up to talk in the congregation are people who are at all different kinds of levels of awareness and
right.
development, and you have to try to talk so that people can get in on it where they are, which is really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we have that experience with this program, you know, because in a real conversation, a lot happens. You go to different places.
Yep.
You tell stories. You formulate conclusions. You throw out questions.
Yep.
Maybe there's some reading, poetry or text
yep.
or music. And I think we find, and it's always so interesting for me to see how different listeners react to different
mm-hmm.
parts of the conversation.
Right.
And it's a similar process.
Yep. And of course, that's what a preacher gets every Sunday
right.
after church. You get preachers get attacked for what they didn't say. They get thanked for what they didn't say
uh-huh.
because so much of it is in the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
I did want to read this to you. This was from a sermon. I just want to read it because I thought it was beautiful. That you wrote that God is the map whereby we locate the setting of our life. That God is the water in which we launch our life raft. That God is the real thing from which and toward which we receive our being and identify ourselves. It follows that the kind of God at work in your life will determine the shape and quality and risk at the center of your existence. It matters who God is.
I'm glad I said that.
But, you know, again, even just following on all of this, there's, because of the very complex and, as you say, poetic way in which God finds expression in the text, there's a way in which God gets to evolve with us, right, through life.
Right. Yep. That's right. So God as a God brought to speech is a very supple reality in which we exercise great freedom in whom God is now permitted to be among us.
Mm.
I learned that when my son was about seven, and at our table prayers, before I caught on to the gender problem of language, I always addressed God as Father. And that night I thought I would be Jewish, and I addressed God as King of the Universe. And I remember my son had his head bowed, and he came up with eyes as big as saucers because he had never heard God said that way. Well, in retrospect, it wasn't much of a move from Father to King, but you can make more moves the same way. So that every time you find another way of saying it, the reality of God is opened very differently, and that's what they did. And of course, Jesus' parables then work that
right.
very much the same way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I would love for you just to read a little bit more a psalm that you love right now.
Okay.
I don't know, something. Maybe a couple of readings that mean
right.
something to you for whatever reason.
Okay. Part of Psalm 146. Happy are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God, who made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, who keeps faith forever, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets the prisoners free. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the stranger. He upholds the orphan and the widow. And then he adds this, but the way of the wicked he will bring to ruin. The Lord will reign forever. Your God, O Zion, for all generations, praise the Lord.
What does that say to you?
Well, it contrasts, the verses that I didn't read contrasts people who trust in God with princes who trust in themselves. And then this is a recital of who you're trusting in if you trust God, and it's the God who sustains the world, who looks after the vulnerable, and who makes the world a livable place. And then that last line, the way of the wicked he brings to ruin, I take it are when we act to make the world not a livable place, those are the wicked, and they don't have any future. That's what I think.
Okay.
that's true. And then I'll do one other.
Okay.
The book of Psalms ends with these sort of outrageous doxologies.
Okay.
But this is, praise the Lord from the earth, you sea monsters and all deeps, fire, hail, snow, frost, stormy wind filling his command, mountains and all hills, fruit trees and cedars, wild animals and cattle, creeping things and flying birds, kings of the earth, princes and all rulers, young men and women, all old and young together. And it's an image of all creatures joining in doxology. And I love that, to think that sea monsters, I don't know the sea monsters howl or how they express their faith, but it's an early form of all creatures of our God and King. You know,
right.
The whole world is right. coming in doxology, and I just think it's so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I just read a book recently, and I don't know whether it's right, but it says that Socrates said that all true speech ends in doxology to God. I hope he said that. And if he didn't, he should have.
So. Oh, Walter Brueggemann, thank you so much. This has just been great.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you, and I love your program.
thank
you.
That makes me really happy.
Good.
Is there anything that I didn't, that I might, that you'd like to talk about that we didn't?
No.
Okay.
No,
it was a great conversation.
Good.
Thank you.
You're so good at this. Of course she's good at it, isn't she?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. This is all because the world has changed and radio is not just radio anymore. It has lights, sound, camera, action.
So when I want to
tweeting.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. I'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It has, we live stream and people will watch this. And
yep.
The other thing that's been interesting is, we really do put a lot of care into the art and craft of this.
I'm sure you do.
The art and craft of the Radio Hour. But a couple of years ago when Trent came on board, he had us start putting the entire unedited interview out because he said,
really?
Yeah, people want transparency as a virtue. And,
it's
amazing now how many people just go straight to the unedited interview, which almost makes me think, well, why do we do all this work?
Short circuit all your artistry.
Let's just send it out in the world. Yeah.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. But it's both. And I think a lot of people listen to the edited show and then they go back and listen. It's that same thing about taking, digesting, right?
Yep.
Working with.
Right. Of all your programs, and I don't hear it every week, but I thought the one you did with Pelican.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
So extraordinary. Yeah. So, right.
I'm so glad we did that, and I think we'll still be able to put it on the air every once in a while. And
I love being
able to kind of keep him alive. You know what's interesting about that show on Creeds? Because if you remember, that had been that great project that he worked
on. Yes, of course.
I can't tell you how many Unitarians tell me that was their favorite show. Really, just again and again.
Yep. Isn't that interesting?
It's really interesting.
I've tried to think of the name of the physicist whom he said he was in a chorus with.
It was Stephen Jay Gould. It wasn't. Was he a biologist? Paleontologist.
Yeah, he said about if you could send something to another world, it would be Box Corral, I think is what he said, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So.
I know. I know. I love that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the extraordinary people you bring to us is just nothing like it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
We do our best.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, one of my favorite things lately is I interviewed Martin Rees, who's an astrophysicist, and he just won the Templeton Prize. I just love this. So he studies like extreme phenomena in the universe. Black holes, whether there was one Big Bang or multiple Big Bangs, multiverses. And he said, and he's how old is he? He's in his late 70s, right? I mean, he's lived a while. He's been doing this a long time. He said, but the most extreme phenomena, the most complex phenomena in the universe that we know of are ourselves, human beings.
Amazing.
He said, I can tell you definitively true things about the constitution of stars, but you know that you shouldn't believe anyone who tells you they know something that's definitively true about dieting or childcare.
That's wonderful.
It's fabulous. I find it so strangely comforting.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, somehow your doxology and the sea monsters fits together.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Right.
We're going to put that on the air. I don't know when we're going to put this conversation with you on the air because we're kind of moving towards where we take a summer break. So it may be in the fall or in the winter, but we will have this and we'll let you know.
Good.
Won't disappear, but it's going to be after the summer, I think.
Fine. Good.
Might even save it for Christmas or something like that.
Well, it's a great privilege to get to be with you.
Well,
thank you.
Big privilege for me, too. Known about you a lot longer than you've known about me.
Great.
Do we have a car back for you?
He said he was going to be waiting out there, I think. So,
If not, I'll call you enough.
Okay. Good.
It's been a long day. Are you going back to the... No, you're going home now, right?
I just got to go back to the hotel and pick stuff up. If I had a thought, I should have had the brought my stuff with me and go to the airport. Yeah. But I didn't say, so. It's all right. Put this on. Well, thank you. Good. Appreciate it. Good. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for making this work. Yeah, that's great.